I'll just start with a poem, actually, which many of you will have heard before. We used to say it regularly on Saturday mornings before the meditations, or I did at least. I'm not sure if it's said regularly these days. It's by Tsongkhapa, who is a Tibetan teacher from a long-dead Tibetan teacher. I can't remember what century he was alive in. Well, I'll just read you the poem. Cherish your body. It's yours this one time only. It's won with difficulty, and it's easy to lose. All worldly things are brief, like lightning in the sky. And this life, you must know, is a tiny splash of a raindrop. So that's a good kind of introduction to this talk, which is around the preciousness of human birth. As Sujiva was reminding us, Purna introduced us to these Tibetan teachings. They're either called the Four Mind-Turning Reflections or the Four Reminders. And Purna's suggestion was that the Four Reminders was more, I think, both more pithy and more helpful, because they're, it's just a list, really, a list of four things that help remind us about what's most important in life. So the first asks us to reflect on a particular phrase, which goes, this rare and precious human life of leisure and opportunity. So what is this rare and precious human life of leisure and opportunity? There's a lot in that phrase, obviously, even though it's just one of the reminders. So I'm going to start with leisure and opportunity, what that's pointing to, and then I'll come back to this rare and precious human life. So in the context of this teaching, leisure refers to time. Many people on this earth spend every available moment trying to survive, finding food, finding shelter, and finding safety. We're not in that situation. Well, most of us aren't in that situation, but sometimes we act as if we are, as if meeting the next deadline or completing the next project is a life and death matter. In fact, it's not, and this reflection is encouraging us to remember that we do have leisure time, and even time that is spent at work or doing shopping or jobs or driving or whatever does include a certain element of leisure. We're not pushed to survive every moment of the day. So, for example, I can choose how I behave. There's a lot of choice in how I behave at work. And my actions at work can either serve my spiritual journey or they can detract from it. So it's worth asking yourself, do I work to support my spiritual practice, or do I use my spiritual practice to make me more effective at work? And it might not be an either-or answer. There might be a bit of both in that. And so I'll just remind you of that question along with a few others at the end of this talk. And then there's the time that we officially think of and call leisure time. What do we do with that time? So if we just take on board for a moment that this human life is rare and precious, do our leisure activities reflect that? There's a Dharma teacher called Alan Wallace who's written about these four reminders, and he says that leisure is an empty vessel that we can fill with the nectar of the Dharma. So it's a lovely metaphor, isn't it? Leisure is this empty vessel that we can fill with the nectar of the Dharma. So I've been wondering how I fill that empty vessel, although when I think of my leisure time, it doesn't actually feel that empty, but anyway, that's because I fill it up with stuff which probably doesn't necessarily reflect the Dharma. So do I fill leisure time with kindness, creativity, mindfulness, care for others, or do I fill it with something else? You might like to ask yourself that same question. So this rare and precious human life of leisure and opportunity. So opportunity is simpler. It relates to leisure, of course. It's the opportunity to practice the Dharma. It's just describing the situation all of us find ourselves in here. We have the opportunity to come tonight and listen to the Dharma, practice the Dharma. We've come across it and we do have the capacity to bring it into our lives. So that's leisure and opportunity. So this rare and precious human life. What can that mean? The rarity of human life. There's so many billions of people on this planet. How can human life be rare? It seems it's very easy to be born. So the Tibetans take the very long view on this one, seeing one human life in the perspective of eons of time and billions of beings. And there's a turtle that's often told, the story of a turtle that's often told to illustrate this. Many of you will have heard the story of the turtle. Apparently it's a blind turtle. So there's a blind turtle which lives for thousands and thousands of years. And thousands of years just means it lives forever, I think, in the context of this story. It's swimming around in the world's seven oceans, so swimming for thousands and thousands of years. And on the surface of the oceans is a yolk. And it's not the yolk of an egg. I think it was Joe that thought it was the yolk of an egg. Or somebody. Anyway, it's not the yolk of an egg, it's a yolk, which I googled. A yolk is what is used to kind of fasten oxen together when they're ploughing, right? It's a wooden yolk floating on the surface of the world's seven oceans. And once every 100 years, right, the blind turtle comes to the surface to take a breath, right? So what are the chances of that blind turtle sticking its head through the yolk when it surfaces? And that chance is said to be the chance of any one of us achieving a precious human birth. So it's a bit mind-boggling, isn't it? It's, according to the Tibetan tradition, it's highly unlikely, to say the least, that we will achieve a human birth. And yet here we are, all are sitting here. And I was thinking about the yolk thing once I saw the picture on Wikipedia of this wooden yolk. And I was thinking, God, that adds an interesting dimension to this metaphor. While the reflection is saying that the human life is rare and precious, the metaphor of the yoke is suggesting that it's also incredibly hard work, like having to pull a plough around a sun-baked Indian field for days and days and days for an entire lifetime. And you know, maybe that's just my temperament, maybe not, but I find this helpful because it feels very realistic, particularly in the depths of this cold winter, when life can feel especially challenging. So when I came up with the title for this talk, what is it? Human life? Yeah, being human, curse or blessing. I didn't really know what I was going to talk about, but then I came across this picture of a wooden yoke and realised, yes, life, of course, is both. It's like a yoke that yokes us to a really hard and challenging task for a whole lifetime, and what this reflection is pointing to that also is that it's extremely precious and rare. So the precious human birth is kind of that term, it's kind of a technical Tibetan term, which is used not just for someone like one of us with a human form, but for someone with a human form who has what are called the eight freedoms, the 10 endowments, and the 3 kinds of faith. So it's not just any old human birth, but a very fortunate human existence. So I'll come back to the freedoms and endowments a wee bit later, but I'll just kind of take my own tangent and highlight some of the themes that run through, particularly through the freedoms. So when I was thinking about this talk, I realised that to think about the human life as rare or precious or anything else, I felt I needed to compare it to something else that wasn't a human life. Like to compare to say a meal is incredibly delicious, you have to kind of have in mind a meal that wasn't quite so delicious. There needs to be a point of comparison. So I want to compare this human life with, last time I was thinking, sitting here doing a talk, I kept pointing up here to the Tibetan Wheel of Life, which I'm going to do a bit of again. I was thinking, oh, that's a really useful symbol or a way of thinking about the human life and how it can be less than precious. So in that image, there's 6 realms, and the human realm was just one of them. And in the traditional teachings, we could be born into the human realm, like literally, as we are, or we could literally be born into another realm, depending on our actions in a previous life. So we could be born into a hell realm or an animal realm or one of the other realms. I don't find that way of looking at the symbol particularly useful or convincing or helpful. But I think it is helpful to think about these realms as psychological states. Probably said this last time. But I can relate to that because I know all the states that are depicted to some degree or other. And although in some of those states, so psychological states, reflection isn't possible, or is barely possible to reflect on your circumstances in those states. In retrospect, when I think about what it was like to be in them, I can start to identify well, what's missing from them that is available to me in a more kind of human realm or human state. So I'll just, so my line of thinking is, I'll look at some of those realms and highlight some of their key features and start to identify what's missing that we have access to when we're in a more human state. So the hell realm is, obviously enough, it's filled with hellish suffering. That could be emotional suffering, physical suffering. It's incredibly painful and it feels like it will go on forever. So maybe you can't recall being in such a terrible state, or maybe you can. Maybe you can recollect a time of despair when the world just seemed incredibly bleak and you couldn't imagine a way out of it. Or maybe you can recollect a time of regret or shame where you just couldn't see any way of redeeming yourself and you felt like you'd be stuck in that awful sense of shame and guilt forever. I mean, those are the two that sprung to mind for me. So that's just a pointer at the hell realm. I find the terminology, the animal realm, is a bit hard on actual animals, actually. But it's suggestive of times when we're fixated on physical pleasures, and the usual examples are food, sex and sleep. They're all that we can think about, and in that state we believe that getting them will make us happy. And of course getting those things quite likely will make us happy for a while. But if we inhabit this animal realm for too long, we get bored and our intelligence and sensitivity become blunted. I mean, that's kind of obvious, isn't it? Anyway, it's obvious to me. So the god realm, the gods are... Where are the gods? Up there at the top, I think. Yeah. The god realm, so that's a state of intense happiness. And again, it feels like it will go on forever, which sounds wonderful, doesn't it? It's, God, if only I could be happy forever. But from a Dharmic perspective, it's not a great state to be in because there'd be no reason to practice the Dharma if we were blissfully happy. There'd just be no incentive. There'd be no reason. And in this state, we don't even care about the suffering of others. I'm kind of making this up, but I believe this is probably true. We don't even care about the suffering of others in the god realm. I suppose I'm referring to times of my own when I've been very happy. It's like it's as if, in that state, as if I call to mind that other people are unhappy, it will cast a shadow on my own happiness. It will kind of ruin things for me. So... I don't know if times like that come to mind for you. I think those initial early days or weeks or even months of being in love can feel a bit like that. It's like, oh my God, this is going to last forever and I'm so happy and, you know, this is, and who cares about everyone else kind of thing. There's another realm. There's two more realms I'm going to mention. One's called the realm of the usherers. And usherers is translated as jealous gods. And this realm is characterised by intense competition. So everyone, the picture shows it, everyone's kind of fighting each other for what they think will make them happy. It's a realm of pride, destruction and jealousy in which no resolution can ever be achieved. So there's no space for forethought or reflection. So no possibility of noticing that wild success is always succeeded by abject failure. So perhaps you've inhabited this realm maybe when you've been very focused on doing well in your studies or in your career, and you've put that success or winning that particular race ahead of all the other things in your life, including all the other people in your life. And the realm of the hungry ghosts is similar to that, but it's got a different flavour. Everyone in the realm of the hungry ghosts is grasping for something, anything, that will make them happy. But when they get it, they can't take it in or digest it. The image in the picture there is of these very, very skinny people with big, droopy, slack bellies and tiny, tiny little mouths, just showing that they're skinny, their bellies are really hungry, but they can't take anything in. And this is often seen as the realm of addiction. It's a place of incessant wanting with only small islands of relief succeeded by even more wanting. I was at St. Luke's shopping mall a while ago. Shopping malls don't really suit me at the best of times, but this particular time, I don't know why, but I just caught a flavour of the hungry ghost realm in the shopping mall. It felt very painful. You may have had that experience in a shopping mall, or you may have had a hungry ghost kind of experience in some other context in your life, a time of real wanting where you never actually get what you feel like you need and want, or you only get it for a little while. And then there's the human realm, which I'm assuming we're all in, you know, more or less at the moment, or at least moving in and out of, as with all psychological states, we move in and out of them. And I found it really interesting that the word human can still be used to convey goodness, like to be fully human. There's all kinds of phrases that suggest that being human is a good thing, which is kind of amazing given the amount of destruction that us humans have wrought on each other and on the world, isn't it? You'd think human would be a term of abuse by now, but it's not. But I kind of find this image really useful, because I think, well, if all of us humans could inhabit the human realm all the time, I'm imagining the world would be a very different place, you know, financially, politically, environmentally. It would just be very different. And in thinking in the way that the Tibetan Wheel of Life points to, just shows really clearly how we move in and out of states of mind which are very creative and compassionate and wise, very quickly falling into different states of mind which aren't so much. Sometimes just for a few moments, a few days, a few years, or sometimes for a whole lifetime, I imagine. So I'm kind of building up to what we gain from the human state, or to put it another way, what we lose when we fall into one of the other realms. It's not happiness. It's obviously not happiness, because the gods are supremely happy, so it's not that. And the traditional teachings around this say that in the human state we have the ability to choose and change. And that sounds like, oh yeah, right, of course, we choose and change jobs, partners, outfits, cars, houses, everything, lots of things all the time. And yes, that's part of it, but those kind of obvious things that we choose and change, that's only the tip of a very large iceberg. What the words choose and change are pointing towards is the ability to choose and change the whole trajectory or direction of our lives. And I don't mean just when we make those weighty, heart-wrenching, conscious, deliberate decisions. It's kind of in every moment of every day we have the choice of choosing and changing if we're in a fully human state. So as I mentioned earlier, Buddhism can take the very, very long view, as with the turtle, the blind turtle, but it also takes the very, very short view. Every mind moment makes a difference, and while we can't usually choose what comes to mind, we can choose what we do with it. And in choosing what we do with whatever comes to mind, we influence the course of the next moment and the next moment and the next moment, and eventually an entire life. So that this is a human capacity, and like every capacity, if we don't use it, we lose it. Again, I'm kind of making this up, but I think it's true. Another extremely precious, this is not traditional, this is me. Another extremely precious human quality is empathy. So according to, I think it was Wikipedia or somewhere there, empathy is the ability to identify with or understand another's situation or feelings, and this is a distinctly human quality. It's also a quality that we lose touch with all too quickly. All of us, often, we lose the ability to do that. That's not a judgment, actually. It's just kind of highlighting that that's the fact. We lose the quality to empathise with others quite quickly. So, for example, if we're in a hell realm, our distress is so overwhelming that we're not even aware of others. Or if we're being an ashura, that's the jealous god state. Our need to succeed is... to win at whatever race it is so intense that we disregard the effect of our actions on others. And a clear sign that we've regained the human state is that we start to tune into other beings. I mean, by others, I don't just mean humans, actually. I mean animals, I mean trees, I mean other beings on the planet. So far I've got choose and change, empathy, and then another aspect that's missing from the other realms is the capacity for self-reflection. And by saying self-reflection, I mean we can ask ourselves what we're up to, and when it's not obvious, we can delve deeply and find out what really motivates us. So by saying what we're up to, you know, why we're acting in the way we are, we can think about our internal states and about how they are motivating our actions. So these three qualities combine to create a being who is capable of skillful behaviour and therefore of practising the Dharma. We can investigate our motivations. We can anticipate the consequences of our actions by imagining their effects on ourselves and others. And we can choose to behave accordingly. Which sounds good, doesn't it? It sounds kind of simple. That means we can care for ourselves and others, and in doing so we can create our own futures. However, one of the many downsides of being human, you know, the others being the numerous ways that we cause suffering and do suffer, you know, one of the many downsides is that we are born with the responsibility to use these great gifts. And if we don't take this responsibility seriously, we can easily lose these capacities from one moment to the next as we fall into a state of craving or impatience or despair or whatever, you know, add your own kind of tendencies to the list. Could be anxiety, could be fear. And of course, once we fall, I don't know if the metaphor falling is quite right, but anyway, I'll use it. Once we fall in, we're kind of stuck. We feel stuck and we have to find a way to lever ourselves back into a fully human state where we have empathy, choice, and the capacity for self-reflection. And that's, I think, one of the main problems with the non-human realms, is that there's very little leverage. We lose those capacities, and those are the capacities that give us leverage. So how to do this? How to maintain and sustain the human state so we are best placed to practice the Dharma and create happiness for ourselves and others? So it's obvious, it's kind of obvious, of course. We cultivate the very qualities that characterise the human state. We cultivate skillful choice, we cultivate empathy, and we cultivate the capacity for self-reflection. Did I say empathy? And we cultivate empathy. And to do this, mainly we need to cultivate mindfulness, or to build on that, to convey the warmth of mindfulness, we need to cultivate kindly awareness. And I think the phrase kindly awareness pretty much sums up the capacities that make up being truly human. So I'm now just going to remember it earlier, a little while ago I talked about the 8 freedoms and the 10 endowments. I'll just briefly allude to them. And then come on to how they all kind of connect up. So the first 4 freedoms means the things we are free from. So the first 4 freedoms I covered when I talked about the non-human realms. We're free from being born into those non-human realms. The next freedom is, I love the way the Tibetans put this. I mean, it says a lot about Tibet, I guess. We're free from being born in a barbaric land. So the Tibetans are sitting in Tibet, presumably practicing the Dharmas, thinking, thank goodness we're born here in Tibet. We're not born in a barbaric land. And here in Aotearoa, New Zealand, I think it's apt as well to think about what would that mean to us. We're born with external conditions, most of us anyway, most of us here, not everyone born in this country, but most of us. We're born with external conditions where we can practice the Dharma reasonably effectively. We can... we're not born in a war zone, we're not born in a state of famine. I mean, we could go through the whole list, couldn't we, of the places that it would be very, the kind of places or contexts in which it would be very hard to practice the Dharma. Places or conditions where it's, I mean, and these exist in our country as well, places where it would be very difficult to develop any ethical sensitivity because of the kind of... barbaric conditions that surround us. So another of the freedoms is that we are free from identifying with extreme wrong views. I kind of think this is a slightly dodgy one here in our culture, because I think there are quite a lot of wrong views that we probably identify with to some degree, or at least get seduced by. Consumerism and materialism are obvious ones. But let's say most of us, at least, because we're here tonight, are free from the wrong view that thinking if we are good, we will be rewarded by God. That you could say that was an extreme wrong view. And if you have that view, just think about it. Think about it in relation to the Dharma. Another of the freedom is that we're free from having defective senses. So we need to use our senses to engage with, receive and practice the Dharma. And I think this particular freedom does very much depend on time and place. I think in the Buddha's time, or in Tibet when these reminders were being formulated, being born with a disability would have been much more limiting in terms of the accessibility of the Dharma. Whereas here in Aotearoa, New Zealand, it's not necessarily such an obstacle. And the final of these, how many freedoms were there? The final of these 8 freedoms is that we're free. This is kind of a negative one, and 2 negatives make a positive. We're free from being born at a time when a Buddha has not appeared. So yes, the Buddha did live and die about. More than 2,500 years ago. So yes, we're not being born in the time when the Buddha is alive, but the Buddha's influence is still with us, which means the path to enlightenment is still open to us. So that's that particular freedom. So the next set of qualities are the 10 endowments or gifts, and these are mainly positive expressions of the negative freedoms, if you see what I mean. So having, I'm not going to go into them, because having attained the 8 freedoms, we now have the 10 endowments. So, to summarise, just by fact of being here tonight, it's safe to assume that all of us have been born into conditions where it's possible to practice the Dharma. We've been given the opportunity to act from a fully human state of mind, and we've also come across in the Dharma in a form that's relatively accessible to us. We can buy books, we can download talks, we can meet with other Buddhists, we can roll up here to the centre and hear talks and learn how to meditate. And we also have at least some time available to make use of these resources. And all this combines to mean that we have the potential to change, to grow, to become fully free and fully awake. So I think we all know, I'm confident we all know on some level that we are able to go beyond ourselves. I think on some level we recognise our potential for enlightenment. And on a very deep level, it may be barely conscious, that is a driving force in our lives, a very important motivator in our lives. And just knowing that we have that potential for enlightenment, freedom, awakening, whatever word you want to move, helps us live with a sense of urgency and helps us want to help others out of their suffering. It leads to the arising of many other positive qualities of joy, confidence, faith. And it helps us not be overwhelmed when we experience difficulties like pain, despair, depression. All those places where we can get stuck. Because I think even in the... that symbol actually shows that even in the other non-human realms, there still is the potential for enlightenment. I talked about that more in my most recent talk. But in the figure of a particular... in the form of a particular Buddha figure. So even if we feel completely overwhelmed by, say, despair or anxiety, that potential for enlightenment is still with us. When we don't appreciate our lives, our life, and forget that we have the potential to see through to ultimate reality, that's when we start to block our feelings, focus on relatively unimportant things, and become insular and self-absorbed. We lose mindfulness, empathy for others, and it's almost as if we willfully forget that we have the ability to choose and change. So appreciating our lives helps us live with awareness from one moment to the next. It doesn't mean that we're always happy, that we always feel satisfied with our lives, or even that we're always kind and loving. It doesn't mean any of those things, and being a practicing Buddhist doesn't mean any of those things. Life, even though it's precious, can feel like a burdensome yoke at times. It's really helpful to bear in mind that one doesn't rule out the other. You know, the curse or blessing thing, they don't rule out the other. Suffering can coexist with awareness of the preciousness of human life. We have the capacity to hold both. So I think it's really easy to misuse the Dharma, to misuse the Buddha's teachings, to hammer home your own imperfections. So I'd just like to warn you against doing that in relation to this reflection about the rare and precious human life. It wasn't designed to be used as a weapon against yourself. It was designed to inspire and motivate. So just because you, say, feel stuck or depressed or anxious, that doesn't mean necessarily that you're taking life for granted and not making the most of this precious opportunity. All it means is that you're feeling stuck or depressed or anxious or whatever. Our practice, therefore, is to be fully present with the stuckness or depression or anxiety, to be fully present with it, to get to know it with kindly awareness, and to eventually, with practice, to see that it is inevitably impermanent and empty. This isn't easy work. The practice of the Dharma isn't easy work. But then the yoke of human life isn't an easy burden, actually. And Kuslamani will be exploring this theme in 3 weeks when she's talking about the fourth reminder, which is the defects of samsara, the defects of worldly existence. So the first reminder is of course, closely related to the next one, which highlights that life is brief. And not only is it brief, we don't know when it's going to end. So I think most of you were here last week, actually. Do you remember Purna talked about how people get very focused on what's important in their lives when they only have a few weeks or even days to live? I remember he used that term bucket list as if he'd never come across it before. It was really sweet because Purna kind of lives a a different sort of Dharma life than us worldly people. Anyway, what he was saying is if people only have a few days or weeks to live, that their bucket list suddenly gets very, very simple and they realise what truly matters. It's not, I just came up with some things I hear people say. It's not necessarily walking through Tuscany or horse riding in Mongolia or climbing Mount Everest or, you know, add your own thing. I imagine most of us, and this is what Purna was talking, was pointing at, I imagine that if we only had a few days or weeks to live, we'd suddenly become fully present and aware without needing these exciting, novel experiences to help us feel truly alive. I imagine we just treasure the time we had left to be with ourselves, with the people we love, and with our deepest sense of knowing, our faith, if you want to use that, that word. We'd realise that this was what was most important to us. And these four reminders, they're encouraging us to do that right now and from now onwards in every moment of our lives, to realise what's most truly important and to live from that that realisation. So I'm actually at this, I'm now moving into the territory of Kamala Devi. Kamala Devi is speaking next week about impermanence, so I will stop there. But I'll just, I'm just going to finish by reminding you of some of the questions I've raised and highlighting some of the precious qualities of being human. So I suggested that you think about what you do with your leisure time, your so-called leisure time. Do you fill it with the nectar of the Dharma, or do you fill it with something else? And I suggested you ask yourself about your approach to work. This could be paid work, or this could be anything in your life that you kind of see as work. Do you work to support your spiritual practice, or do you use your spiritual practice to make yourself more effective at work? And while being human is complex, I've suggested that it's characterised by three qualities: the ability to choose and change, the capacity for empathy, and the capacity for self-reflection. So you might like to think about whether you take these qualities for granted, or whether you actively exercise them and to keep them in good working order. If you don't lose it, you use it. That's it. So